Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about the life of Samuel Clemens, a man who wrote under the pen name Mark Twain. And our guest for the show is Ron Powers, author of a new, relatively new, biography of Twain, a book that was first published last September in hardcover and then came out in paperback last month. The title of the book is Mark Twain, A Life, and it's published by the Free Press. Certainly welcome here this morning as we talk about Samuel Clemens. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A word about our guest, Ron Powers, is a Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning writer and critic. He is the author of 10 books, co-author of two, including the New York Times bestseller Flags of Our Fathers. He's written for a number of periodicals, including, most recently, The Atlantic Monthly. He wrote the introduction to The Tragedy of Pudd'nhead Wilson and Those Extraordinary Twins for a new modern library anthology of Twain's works, as well as a profile on Twain for the 2004 edition of the Oxford Encyclopedia of American Literature. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Powers, hello.
Good morning, Dave. It's nice to be back in Champaign-Urbana. I used to cover the Illinois State High School basketball tournament there back in shortly after the Civil War when I was writing for the Post-Dispatch. And a little tiny town, the team was called the Cobden Apple Knockers, kept going to the finals. So I have terrific memories of Champaign-Urbana.
Oh, wow. I would pay money for a T-shirt that had that on there.
Well,
I'm really pleased that you could be with us.
It is my pleasure.
Certainly, there were American writers before Mark Twain, and yet so many writers that have come along since have talked about Mark Twain as being somehow the foundation of American literature. Why is that, do you think? What is it about Mark Twain and his writing that so many writers since identify with so strongly?
Well, you're absolutely right, Dave. There were many writers in America before him, and some of them are among our most enduring giants. There is Longfellow, there is Ralph Waldo Emerson, certainly Walt Whitman, who was a contemporary and had really a similar impact, I think, on American letters to Mark Twain. The thing that made him different from the truly great writers before him, those Concord and Boston Brahmins who really kind of set the tone and really invented American literature, was that these guys were still sort of playing and writing by European rules. And European rules meaning a very high-blown and formal kind of diction, an ornateness, certainly a strong will to be polite and sort of to uplift the reader and draw the reader up to high and lofty ideas. Nothing wrong with that, except that this was Europe. This wasn't America. America was a raw, improvising, outward-pushing country still back, you know, in the 1860s and 70s. People spoke differently to one another than they did in the hallowed chambers of Westminster and the Sorbonne. And we needed a writer to hear that language and dignify it and elevate it and get it up into our own literature. And that's what Sam did. He did it most notably, of course, with Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, but he had a few things in print before then that caught everyone's attention. Really rule-breaking essays and sketches, and yet people understood that something valid and important was being worked out here.
Yeah, and certainly one of the things that's striking is that, again, while there were people in Twain's time that were writing that were popular.
Yeah.
You think of someone, for example, like his good friend William Dean Howells. No one reads him now, but we still read Twain. So there's got to be something important going on here that people can still identify with, lo, these many years after Mr. Clemens passed.
Yeah. Howells is such a great character. I love that guy as he reached out to Sam and I write a lot of my book. Well, first of all, a lot of my book is in Sam's voice through his letters and his diaries and also the letters that people wrote to him. So he wrote so much, and it's also available that I could use these letters and journals almost as a novelist would use dialogue. So he's on stage as much as I can get him, and one of his great correspondences was with William Dean Howells, who was then the editor of the Atlantic, which kind of was the house organ of the Boston Brahmins. It was the attempt to transplant European learning out here into the boondocks. And I think of Mark Twain and William Dean Howells kind of like Sherlock Holmes and Watson in a way, because Sam was, I keep going back from Mark Twain to Sam, I hope you'll forgive me, it's a tick that I have. Sam was quick and nervous and lean and outspoken, and he wasn't afraid of vernacular. Howells was a sort of humid, little roly-poly, earnest man with a walrus mustache who took it upon himself to be kind of the custodian of all that was lofty and mighty in American letters. But it was Howells who recognized the power in this first book that Sam generated, which was The Innocents Abroad. And that was his account of that excursion to the Holy Land aboard a steamship called the Quaker City in 1869. And he came back with notebooks brimming with kind of playful anecdotes about his fellow passengers, the way they spoke, their mannerisms, their comic foibles. And he also took a very jaundiced view of the great treasures of Europe, the cathedrals, the art, and even the Holy Land itself. There was a kind of comic skepticism that had never been done before by an American writing, because, you know, the template was reverence and awe. Howells, of all people, you know, as I say, the gatekeeper of everything that is lofty, understood that there was a new, valid, wild voice. And he published a favorable review of The Innocents Abroad in the Atlantic, and that got Sam over the threshold from the Wild West where he'd been before he came back east to go on this excursion. And so Howells gave Sam his legitimacy, and over a 40-year friendship that is filled with playfulness and generosity and fun, Sam gave Howells his boyhood back, almost the boyhood he had never lived. So it's one of the great friendships of the 19th century, and it's one that I have a lot of fun evoking in Mark Twain Alive.
Sam Clemens was arguably, well, I was about to say maybe the most famous American of his time. Maybe not the most famous, but he certainly was one of the most famous.
Maybe with Lincoln, I think he probably was.
And he was, not only was he a celebrity in the United States, he was an international celebrity in almost in the contemporary sense.
Very true.
And he made a very significant amount of money by doing personal appearances. So to what extent, here's the question I'm going with, to what extent was Mark Twain a character that Sam Clemens created and played?
Well, Mark Twain was certainly a character. We'll give him that. He was one of the great charismatic figures, and his power over an audience, his ability to mesmerize and cause an audience in a lecture hall to literally explode with laughter and pound their and get red in the face and lose their breath. That was something that almost nobody before him had been able to do, and we can talk about how he accomplished that a little later if you'd like. Mm-hmm. So he was a character. I don't believe in this kind of stereotype about him now that's been in place for about 100 years from his biographers and scholars. I don't believe that there was any kind of invention going on. I don't think that Sam Clemens sat down one day and said, let's see, I think I'll be Mark Twain, and I'll be droll and funny and witty, although in real life I'm not. That didn't happen. All of us, Dave, have multiple personalities. God knows I do. And I think the very fact that he had two names, Samuel Clemens, the name he was born with, and Mark Twain, his pen name, and the fact that he himself was so interested in duality, the divided nature of man, and twins, and lightness, and dark, and all these things that he was preoccupied with, I think made it very tempting for biographers to kind of judge him by this Freudian yardstick. And I will tell you that I don't want to make any great claims for my biography. It's not one of the great works of Western literature. But I think I depart from all of the other works about him because I just throw this diagnostic approach out the window. I don't care when he was Sam and when he was Mark Twain. I want to get that man on stage and let the reader walk around the 19th century with him, hear him talk, watch him think, watch his passion, see the works develop, and see the connective tissue between his ideas and the way we live today. I think he really was an important prophet of our time.
Well, it sounds like the long and the short of it would be that if you had been lucky enough to see Samuel Clemens, see him do his thing, you would have been seeing Samuel Clemens. Yes, you saw Mark Twain, but the man that you saw was the real man. It wasn't the idea that this was a theater piece and he was performing some kind of character that was not truly him.
Oh, yeah, very important, Dave. Well put. I really think that's important because to divide him like that, as so many biographers have done, trivializes him and makes him seem sort of like an imposter or a very cold and calculating businessman who decided that he had a good marketing scheme, as we would say today. Now, I'm sure that many of your listeners have read Justin Kaplan's great book of 1966, which he called Mr. Clemens and Mark Twain, and it was, in fact, a kind of a Freudian diagnosis. But Kaplan did it with a lot of restraint and a lot of intelligence and never made a big deal out of sort of prying this guy's head open and deciding where the one personality stopped and the other started. I respect that book. I don't have all that much respect for some of the later versions of that approach. I guess I feel another thing about biography in general. I think if the writer works hard enough, does enough research and finds enough letters and gets the evidence on the page, the reader can make those judgments. If somebody reading Mark Twain: A Life wants to decide that he was in fact a dual personality, that's okay because then the reader and I are collaborators. But thank you for understanding the difference and the importance of throwing that template aside once in a while.
Our guest in this hour, Ron Powers. He's the author of a recent biography, new biography of Mark Twain, which is titled Mark Twain: A Life, published by the Free Press, just recently come out in paperback. Questions are welcome. We have someone ready here to join the conversation. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Callers in the nearby community of Belgium. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I have several thoughts I could talk about on this thing. I'm going to try to limit it as much as I can. First off, you said he wasn't very calculating, but he was definitely an entrepreneur, because how many things did he get involved in that failed? I mean, he would try any scheme whatsoever to make money on.
Mm.
And some of them succeeded, and most of them didn't seem to.
You're right.
He lost several fortunes. The other thing, another comment that I want to make is that was the interesting aspect that Twain really started off as a Southerner who understood slave ownership.
Yes.
And during the process of writing Huckleberry Finn and his relationship with the Harriet Beecher Stowe, which I think was his next door neighbor, if I remember right.
At Nook Farm in Connecticut. Right.
Yeah, something like that. He changed his mind and became an abolitionist, which was very good for him. But the real crux that I'd like to get to is, you said he was probably one of the most famous people, but at the same time, wasn't he involved with Grant and his biography?
Oh, yes.
And at that point, Grant was just almost more famous than Lincoln at that time, because he had ended the Civil War, which was a horrid event, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else seemed to be able to get the job done. And when Lincoln went to Grant, the job was able to get done.
Yes.
And Clemens and Grant, though everybody says they were great friends, they seemed to only develop a friendship after the Civil War. I wonder how that happened. And I almost wonder if Clemens and his publication of Grant's work also wasn't another scheme to make some money for both of them.
Well, sure. It was. Just hang on, if you'll excuse me just a second, please. Even biographers have to cough sometime, Dave, and I just did.
That's fine.
A lot on the plate from our caller, who is clearly very well versed in Mark Twain. Let me see. Let's go back and take some of the early points. The entrepreneurship, it's a delightful facet of him, although, of course, it ruined him. His compulsion to pour thousands of dollars into the page typesetting machine in the 1880s and 90s really did wreck his fortune. But here again, this was the Gilded Age. These were the years after the Civil War, when all of that technology that the war had made necessary was now being converted to lighting our cities and improving our communications. Railroads were lacing the Northeast, and everybody was an inventor. Every shoe clerk went out to the back shed at night and put an eye shade on and turned a candle on and tried to invent the better mousetrap. And Sam and his brother, Orion, were very much a part of that. And it's comic until it gets very serious. He tries to invent a pair of pants that will stay up by themselves, with an elastic band in back. I guess he hadn't heard of the belt. He invented a self-pasting scrapbook that actually did make him some money. Orion, his sort of ne'er-do-well older brother, was working on a rocket ship. So they were part of that culture of optimism and progress, and with Sam, it just went too far. Now, the celebrity, let's talk about the relationship with Grant. It's a fascinating relationship. The caller says that they didn't really become close until after the Civil War. Absolutely true, but I've been able to go back and find some evidence that these men's lives were sort of intertwining almost in a karmic way from a very early age. 1850s, Mexican War was over. Grant himself couldn't make a living at anything. He goes to St. Louis. He gets a job in an insurance brokerage house. There's nothing for him to do. He doesn't know the business. So he wanders around the building, and he finds his way into the office next door, which is a bank office. And the proprietor of the bank is a man named William Moffett. William Moffett is Sam's brother-in-law. And Grant kills time in that office. Grant chased a little ragtag band of Confederate guerrillas around Missouri in the early weeks of the war, the Marion Rangers, they call themselves. Sam was a part of that outfit for 3 weeks and wrote one of the great enduring pieces, A Private History of a Campaign That Failed, about his experiences. He finally deserted. He finally left, walked away. A lot of the guys did. If he had stayed, it would have been possible that U.S. Grant's first military engagement would have been fought on the very land in which Sammy Clemens was born, Florida, Missouri. That didn't happen, but they circled each other again after the war. Sam was fascinated by him, and yes, as the caller said, at the end of Grant's life, when he was riddled with cancer and he himself was broke by trusting too many bad guys around him, Sam got those memoirs published, and Grant died, but they bailed his company, his family, his wife Julia, out of debt. And also, it was he created one of the great works of war literature that is still read and admired today.
You did miss the part about slavery, which I thought was very interesting, with his trip down, because he did finish writing Huckleberry Finn on a steamboat trip. I think he started in Hannibal and went on south to New Orleans, and he just got very, very depressed with it, but did write the finish of Huckleberry Finn.
He took notes for what became the finish. That voyage, of course, produced Life on the Mississippi.
Yes.
But the slavery thing, I don't think there was one moment of conversion for Sam, like the friendship with Harriet Beecher Stowe, although that was very important. That was a whole community of abolitionists. I believe, we've had a very kind of depressing 25-year controversy finally died down a little bit over whether he was a racist because he used the terrible, loathsome word nigger 211 times in Huckleberry Finn, one of the worst words that that our language has produced, and there's no question about that. If you look, first of all, if you look at the use of that word, he is quoting the speakers of his time, and he's speaking through the voice of a 14-year-old boy who grew up in slave country, as he did. But I think that Sam's journey upward and outward from racial prejudice was sort of a lifelong pilgrimage. He accepted it as a boy because everybody in his town accepted it, including the preachers in the pulpit. But I think the thing that saved him, one of the things, was that he had his mother, Jane, uneducated backwoods Kentucky woman, was filled with humanity, had a great hatred of human suffering, and Sam inherited that. He had a strong, instinctive sense of justice, and so whether or not he could form a philosophy of racial relations, his heart always told him that it was wrong to oppress people, and there are dozens of instances in his life in which he plays that. Let me give you one pretty well-known one that I still don't think gets the attention it deserves. In the 1890s, I believe, he financed the Harvard education of a young black lawyer named Warner Gwinn. Said, in effect, this is the least we can do for the people that we have wronged and oppressed so horribly. Gwinn gets a law degree at Harvard, becomes a successful attorney, and becomes the mentor of another young lawyer named Thurgood Marshall. So there in itself is a great lineage. I would say that, judged in the context of his times, Sam was a radical anti-racist.
I think I'm glad the caller brought up the point, and I hope you'll forgive me for wanting to go on here. But it was certainly something that shows you something of his complexity,
yes.
Of how perhaps as a person he changes over time, and that we maybe misunderstand him or try to oversimplify if we say, as some people have, well, he was just a racist, or if we say, as some people have, well, for his time, his attitudes were very progressive. Well, I suppose it's possible that he could have been in some way both those things, or maybe at some point in his life,
yeah,
he could have been both those things. And certainly,
well, I think so.
he grew into someone who felt very strongly about,
right,
slavery and that it was wrong. He was very strongly became very anti-imperialist later in his life. So he definitely changed over the course of his life.
He did change. And there's something interesting about artists, Dave. sometimes the work you do as an artist, and certainly as a writer, can take you places you hadn't expected, can take you places inside yourself you hadn't known were there. I think that when Sam began to hear the voice of Huck in his head, and when he put that voice in tandem with another voice that he had been enthralled with in childhood, the voice of old Uncle Dan'l, the slave on his Uncle John Quarles' farm, who told ghost stories to the kids at night, black and white, and who mesmerized Sammy. And Sammy stored that dialect up. And when he was ready to write Huck Finn, there it was, ready for him to use. But it was these voices, I think, that led him down a path of sort of cause and effect, of moral probability. And when it got to I don't think he ever decided, well, tomorrow I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a passage that has Huck tearing up a letter telling where Jim is and saying, all right, then I'll go to hell. That is the one line in Huckleberry Finn that people fasten on that changed American literature. He wrote it. I think he wrote it on instinct, on a kind of, it was probably an intuitive moment. So, you know, but he married the daughter of an abolitionist. He was a friend of William Douglas. Howells, who knew him better than anyone, said, the most humane man I have ever known, utterly respectful of Negroes, a direct quote from Howells. So I think we can let him off the hook after all these years as being a racist.
We're at our midpoint here. We have some other callers. Our guest is Ron Powers. He is the author of a recent biography of Mark Twain. The title is Mark Twain, A Life, published by Free Press. It's just recently now come out in paperback. Ron Powers is a Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning writer and critic. He's the author of 10 books and co-author of two, including the New York Times bestseller Flags of Our Fathers. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller up is in Urbana. This would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I understand that at one point in Sam Clemens's life, he was interviewed by Rudyard Kipling, and I was wondering how the two of them got along.
I think he was mad at Rudyard Kipling because Kipling actually attended one of his talks on the lecture circuit. Sam would go around by railroad train, you know, and lecture and sort of promote the books that he had coming out. And among the things that got him hopping mad would be when a journalist would show up and take down his speech in shorthand and then print it, so that when he got to the next town, he would have to make up a new lecture from scratch. I think that Kipling did that and got under Sam's skin, but I think eventually they came to respect one another. And apropos that, the list of people he knew, the list of 19th century figures who changed things, who were prominent, is unbelievable. I keep thinking of that old Woody Allen movie, Zelig, in which Zelig keeps showing up, you know, in great moments in history. And that Sam actually did that. And we can talk more about that. The creation of the Wild West in Virginia City, the founding days of the American counterculture in San Francisco during the war years, when he ran into Bret Hart and Ada Isaacs Menken and all of these free spirits who called themselves bohemian in those days, but who created the lineage that trailed down through the beatniks of the 50s, the hippies of the 60s, and whatever remains of our counterculture these days, of the avant-garde. He was very much a part of that as well.
Yeah, I was wondering because, the two of them gave voice to a class that was not normally heard in literature.
That's right. You would say the voice of the common people. Is that what, the people who live down at Ground Zero?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite quotes that he said in reference to Kipling was, I think that man knows everything there is to know, and I know the rest.
And I know the rest. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. What, Ms. Brown, what do you think that it is important, was it important that Sam Clemens started his writing as a journalist?
Yes, I certainly do. There was, he sat out the Civil War on the coattails of his brother Orion, when Orion was appointed acting secretary of the Nevada Territory because he'd done a little campaigning for Lincoln in Missouri. And there he had a letter with the Lincoln signature saying, this man is the acting secretary. They went out to Nevada on a stagecoach. Sam went along as Orion's assistant, thanking God every mile of the way that he'd been rescued from this terrible war that was about to happen. Orion got there and did what he did in the political realm and was moderately successful. Sam, as we all know, tried his luck at silver mining, couldn't make a penny off the Comstock Lode, probably the only miner in the history of the Comstock Lode who went broke trying. In desperation, he catches on with a little obscure mountainside newspaper called the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City. And that connection, I think, changed everything. Territorial Enterprise was, I think it was the Village Voice of its day, or the Rolling Stone of its day. It was staffed by these wild-eyed fugitives who were headed west, who were sort of renegades. They made their own rules about language. They weren't polite. They weren't Emersonian. And they filled the paper with tall tales and hoaxes and mock feuds. And the young 22-year-old editor, Joe Goodman, understood what they were doing and the beauty of it and let it happen. So when they weren't doing tall tales and hoaxes, they really were paying attention to the people of that territory, the settlers, the outlaws, the gamblers, the card sharks who came in following the riches. And they wrote as those people talked. Sam was in the middle of it. He did it better than anybody. He had the best ear of anyone. The Jumping Frog is the best example of that. And he brought it back east with him. And that's what he brought to Innocence Abroad. And that's what William Dean Howells saw and forgave, because he understood the poetry and the moral clarity and the genius underneath that roughness. So, yes, journalism was a very important part of his formation.
Let's talk with another listener. This is someone in Danville, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. In relation to his tremendous success speaking to audiences and so on.
Yes.
There was one notable disaster in the Whittier dinner,
oh, yes,
in which he had misgauged his audience. Was that the only such instance?
Well, it may not have been. So, his lecture tours were uneven. He would get bad press in some towns and good press in others. And I'm talking about this barnstorming that he did when he was still a relatively young man, when he called himself the Vandal. And he was going around giving talks about the Holy Land, and he did shock some people. But what you're talking about is the thing that haunted him for the rest of his life after it happened. It was the 70th birthday of John Greenleaf Whittier, held in Boston, and it was a gathering. It was like an all-star reunion of the Brahmins. Emerson was there. Longfellow was there. It was a brilliant evening. Someone said the most accomplished room full of people in American history. And Sam was invited by Howells to give the final toast of the evening. And Sam decided that he would do what had worked for him in the past. He would kid these great eminences along, and he invented a comic tale in which they had their same names and spoke in their poetic lines, but they were broken down miners in a mining camp. And as he spoke, he began to be aware that a terrible hush had descended on the room, and his own voice began to croak, and he finished the speech and sat down again, and there was this horrified pause. And he was so mortified that he actually left the country. He took Livy and the children to Europe several months after that, just to live down the humiliation. Now, having told that story, I can tell you that there is some evidence that it really wasn't all that bad. The newspapers that first reported it said that it went over fairly well, but as it spread through the country and got into the Chicago Tribune, the St. Louis Globe Democrat, the resistance started to build up. And I think that what Sam remembered was the criticism that happened after the talk, but it blistered his memory. And here I'm going to risk meandering on, and stop me, Dave, when you
no,
want
go
to.
Ahead. No, go ahead.
This is where General Grant comes back into the picture, back into his life. A year after that speech, he comes back to America, and he's invited to Chicago for a reunion of the Grand Army of the Tennessee. That was Grant's army. And these 80,000 old soldiers are going to get together and toast their leader. Grant himself was president. It was present. He'd already been president. And Sam decides to go, and he risks everything by giving a comic toast, again, the last one of the evening, to Grant. And it is risky because it portrays Grant as a little baby in a crib sucking his toe. And again, when he starts to get to that part of it, the pause descends, and these old veterans who would walk through fire for Grant began to look at him in a very gimlet-eyed way. And Sam is talking about this little baby, Ulysses S. Grant, trying to get his toe into his mouth. And he concludes, a long pause, and then he concludes, "And if the child was father to the man, we know he succeeded." And man, that did it. The house, the roof went off, the Palmer House in Chicago. They were laughing and pounding him on the back, and Grant himself, who never smiled, who had a very sober face, was broken up, and it was probably the happiest evening of Sam Clemens' life.
Let's talk again with another caller. Here's someone in Urbana, where we are, line 1. Hello.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about his attitude toward Benjamin Franklin. I understood he joined Thoreau and Emerson and Melville in attacking Franklin. And could you talk a little bit about that, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Did you say attacking Franklin?
Yes. Yeah. Like, for example, he had said that his autobiography, to quote, was of a vicious disposition that would inflict suffering upon the rising generation of all subsequent ages, unquote.
Well, you've got the evidence. I have to, it's like I say to the teacher, I forgot to do that part of my homework. I don't know of that remark of his, and thank you for enlightening me. What I can tell you about the presence of Ben Franklin in his mind was that in certain ways, Ben Franklin was the Mark Twain of his time, in that he came up as a printer, learned to write, learned to read, learned to appreciate literature, partly by the work he did on a printing press as a boy. Pardon me, please. Orion, especially, Sam's older brother, styled himself after Franklin and decided he would be the next one. He had a little, two-bit printing press in the Clemens household and actually published a newspaper. I'm not aware that Clemens or Mark Twain had any particular vitriol for Franklin, although your quote makes it sound indeed as though he did. His humor could sound pretty rough sometimes. But I don't think that Franklin... Walter Scott, Sir Walter Scott, you know, the creator of Ivanhoe and all the great romantic works of English and Scottish literature. Sam detested Scott because he thought Scott was responsible for the Civil War by giving the South a kind of false notion of chivalry that the South tried to live up to, and he thought that was very phony and destructive and unrealistic. But I think Franklin was one of his great, and Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Christian Science, he had a lot of vitriol for her. But he spread it around pretty good, I guess.
I think that's interesting the call should bring up Franklin, because he's another person that I think of as being someone who, it is said, well, certainly Franklin was, in his day, maybe one of the most famous Americans.
Yes.
He was internationally known as a scientist and for his involvement in the New America and so forth.
Correct.
And also is one of those people that I think is often pointed to as being a distinctly American figure, someone who, in a sense, also embodied the America of his
time. That's right.
So in that sense, I would sort of I put these two men in the same kind of category.
Yeah, I think that Sam could be jealous sometimes of people he felt were too similar in their in their achievements to him. But as I say, I'm not aware that there was a lot of sustained rancor toward Franklin. There may well have been, however.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, just very quickly, let me introduce again, is Ron Powers. He's the author of a recent biography of Twain that's titled Mark Twain, A Life. It's published by Free Press, just come out in paperback. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I think probably now most people, if they've read any Mark Twain, they've read Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer, admittedly two very different books.
Mm-hmm.
The one, certainly, people have a lot of affection, I'm sure, for Tom Sawyer. Huck Finn is the book that most people, I think, would say that was his greatest piece of writing.
Right.
But in both cases, I wonder, when we read those books, do we see something of Sam Clemens as a child? Will that really be a reflection of something of America in his childhood? And in fact, was Huckleberry Finn something of an elegy for the America of his childhood?
Yeah. Well, I think we see Sam Clemens the child in certain ways in almost everything he does, in his playfulness on the lecture stage, when he sort of teases the audience with his pauses and gets them in the palm of his hand. His wife, Olivia, who came from the great aristocratic Langdon family of Elmira, always called him youth. He was very close to his three daughters, the daughters who were part of that great, happy 20-year interval in Hartford. He was always attuned. He was, I think, Howells. he let William Dean Howells loosen up and sort of be silly when they were together, and that was great. As to the writing, you see traces of that, and I think one of the tragedies about Mark Twain in our time is that we don't read him very much. We know about him. He's kind of hiding in plain sight. He's that guy in the white suit, the Colonel Sanders of literature, who told anecdotes about playing hooky and all of that. But I think there's kind of a built-in bias that Americans have, and I certainly had it, and maybe still do, about trusting, surrendering to anyone who lived that long ago, 100, 150 years ago. He's dead, he's gone, the times are over. What possibly could he have said or thought or written that would be of any interest to me? And I found the answer to that question. When I began researching those letters, Dave, at the University of California, Berkeley, where the great Mark Twain Project is located, the archive, there's something like 12,000 letters out there that he wrote. And some people, some of the archivists think he may have written as many as 50,000. A couple of them think maybe 100,000. And I ask these people there are seven of them, they've worked about 30 years as a team in collecting and annotating his works, including the letters. I ask him, how can you possibly have any enthusiasm, any curiosity about him after all this time? And to a person, and they told me this separately in separate conversations, the answer came back, the more we read him, the better we like him. And man, is that true. Once you get over the hurdle of the past and you start to hear the consistency of his irony and his timing, even on the page, and the way he understands human nature, I think that's what made him survive the 19th century when his fellow comics, Artemus Ward and even Bret Hart, didn't really survive, is that Sam had a pulse on the eternal tendencies of the human spirit. And when you get into that zone of reading him, it is unbridled pleasure. And I urge everybody, put down the latest Danielle Steele and go get Following the Equator or Life on the Mississippi, and it will be very rewarding.
Certainly, people think of him as a humorist, although he was much more than that.
Yeah.
But that invites you to also to think about his famous dark side.
Yeah.
And he certainly was someone who in his life sustained a lot of powerful loss. He lost his father when he was young. His
yes.
brother was killed in a riverboat disaster, and Twain may well have felt some guilt over that because he was the guy who encouraged him to go into that line of work. And then when he became married and had a wife, he lost a son. One of his daughters died when she was only 24. His wife died. Another of his daughters died. So this was a man who maybe now at that time, maybe that wouldn't have been unusual, but he was certainly someone who had a lot, who suffered a lot of loss and for that reason thought an awful lot about life and death and God and his place in the cosmos and all of those sorts of things.
Right. I think there's no disruption between the sorrow and the humor. He recognized that. He said famously, the secret source of all humor is not joy, but sorrow. And then he paused and added, there is no humor in heaven. And part of his genius, I think, Dave, was that he was able to convert the grief and the anger that he felt. And he was, in many ways, a very angry, very vindictive man. But he converted that into humor. I see if I can get it back on the air for you right now. One good example, the captain of the Quaker City, that ship that went to the Holy Land, a man named Duncan, was scandalized by Sam when he showed up at the office to book passage. He was reeking he was hammered, and the captain didn't like that. He was a God-fearing Christian. And so for years after the voyage was over, Captain Duncan would write newspaper articles recalling that Mark Twain showed up at his office reeking of the fumes of bad whiskey. And finally, Sam had had enough. And he wrote a response to one of these articles saying that for a 40-year absolute purist, abstemious man such as Captain Duncan, who never takes a drink, you're not a good judge of whiskey at second hand. And it was funny. Now, you or I or somebody may have just gone ahead and called a lawyer or confronted this guy on the street. Sam turned it around and made Duncan, and he did that again and again. And I'm sure he was quite angry as he formulated that response, but it came out funny. Mm-hmm. And that's one of his great legacies to us.
Let us talk again with someone else here, and this will be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, I read that Mark Twain considered his book on Joan of Arc his masterpiece. Your comment?
Well, he did. He sometimes seemed to understand that he'd done something enormous with Huckleberry Finn. I don't think he began to comprehend the effect that Huck Finn would have on American life as the years went on. But yes, Joan of Arc was really a book that was sort of written to satisfy that beloved daughter, Susie, whom he adored and who always loved her father, but always, you know, she went to Bryn Mawr, and it was like, oh, Dad, you know, she wanted him to be dignified, and she wanted him to be soaring, and his wife Livy did as well. They kind of clung to the idea that what Dave said a few minutes ago, that he was only a humorist, a mere humorist, and they didn't realize that there was no mere to it, that was it. But he wrote Joan of Arc as a way of proving to his daughter and his wife and some of the other people in his life that he was capable of high Victorian prose. And, of course, the book was not very good at all.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. At the end of his life, did Sam Clemens think that he had been a success?
Well, I think he did, Dave, because all he had to do was step out on Fifth Avenue with his daughter Clara in that white suit that he began wearing about 1906 and watch the crowds descend on him. He really was, if not the first, one of our first celebrities who was known around the world because of his image. You know, his image was, you know, in the rotogravure sections of papers. He was probably the most photographed American of the 19th century. He loved to pose for photographs with a cat in his arms or, you know, hanging over the deck of a ship or something. And I think he understood it. I think there was something in his mind that always doubted that someone from his background, his roots, could really be legitimate. I think that haunted him. I think that's why one reason why he wrote Joan of Arc in this high-blown Victorian prose. He understood it, that he was famous, and he enjoyed it. But on a deeper level, there was something unfinished in him, some hunger that remained unslaked until the day he died.
Do you think that in getting close to Mark Twain and spending a lot of time reading his writing and his letters, did that influence your prose style in writing this book?
Well, I don't know. I come from Hannibal, and I think that fact made me run away from him for a long time because I thought, you know, what if a Hannibal guy tries a biography of Mark Twain and screws it up? How bad would that be? But to say whether he influenced, maybe he did. You know, I think, you know, growing up in Missouri, you meet a lot of people with the same general rhythms in their speech and their same kind of ironic approach to life as Sam. He was very much a man of his time and his region, and you can still find traces of it out there. He just did it better than anybody. But if I could write my best sentence could be as bad as his worst sentence, I would consider my writing career a success, believe me.
He was, I guess, you know, going back to what was important about him and all these writers talking about how that was really the beginning of American literature, he probably would have been the first, one of the most famous Americans, maybe first writers, significant people who was not born on the East Coast. He was a Midwesterner,
right,
with everything that attaches to that, and almost, well, I don't know if at that point you could have called that frontier, but it certainly would have been rougher than living in New York City.
Exactly, of course. And the experiences out west, which was even rougher than the Missouri interior, and that, you know, the way he heard real Americans speak English is so important to his literature. And I believe he heard words, he heard spoken language as music. He was a very musical man. He played the guitar, played the piano. His sister, Pamelia, gave lessons in guitar. And in those great aristocratic days in Hartford, after a dinner party, he would jump up from the table and walk over to the piano and sit down and play a spiritual or a jubilee and accompany himself. So I think his way of hearing language as music was really important, and I think the kind of music he heard was not the European symphony, but the beginnings of American jazz. I think he wrote dialect as jazz.
Well, there we will have to stop. If you'd like to read more about the life of Sam Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, you can look for the book that we've mentioned here. It's by Ron Powers. It's a new biography, a relatively new biography. Mark Twain, A Life, has been published just recently in paperback by the Free Press. Mr. Powers, thanks very much.
It's been a great pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you.